was degenerating. And finally, one day, somebody in the fan deck looked up and said, she said, "You know, somebody must have shot the albatross." It was so bad that when they finally got to the Virgin Islands, the governor hit the gangplank and left to the bars and other places of that island. Except for Governor Maddox, who began passing out axe handles. He hadn't checked the constituency, they weren't interested. But what was waiting was all the school children of the Virgin Islands whose teachers had told them American governors are coming and now they will sign your autograph. So sign your autograph. Well, they all left, leaving me and the council of the governor of New Jersey, the only ones with thousands of kids reaching for autographs. And we proceeded to oblige them. My friend was a black. He was the council of the governor of the state of New Jersey. And over the sea of these waiting kids, thinking we were governors, I called out, "Hey, governor," making him the first black governor in the history of the United States. And he, with his pencil poised, called back over those kids and said, "How do you spell Rockefeller?" Well, I know you came to hear some charge. Let me proceed. I know, too, that the purpose of your convention 20 years ago was really to demonstrate to a skeptical bottom 48 that you were mature enough to be a state, that you had the competence to be as senior a member of that union as any of the rest of our states. And it's clear that in 1956, you demonstrated that maturity in your constitutional convention, producing a document that has survived for these 20 years, and not only survived, I think, but with this state has prospered. In 1976, what are you trying to demonstrate by coming back again? There is a waiting world, I would argue, a world, and not simply the United States, that could hang on how you here in these 3 days, as symbolic of what Alaska in the next several years, waiting to see what you do and how you behave. This came to me in June when I was invited to Iran to make a bicentennial address on problems of urban development to the Iranians in Tehran. I brought my son, incidentally, a planner, who also has been with me in Anaktuvik Pass, has watched the North Slope Eskimos deal with the oil consortium, who was impressed as I have been by what you have been here in Alaska. This was our time to check out Iran. Before we made that lecture, and I must say we did because he's now old enough to tell his old man what to write, we went down to Persepolis, a city 2,500 years old, a place of ruins that is still magnificent in the memory of what that culture of Cyrus and Darius and the others produced. When I went back to Tehran to lecture, I was humbled because I was going to talk on the 200th anniversary of my country and they were celebrating their 2,500th year. I talked about Alaska. I did it for a reason, because for reasons I will mention shortly. But I talked about Alaska. You were the anonymous subject until I used the surprise ending and told what community I was talking about. Because I was struck by the similarities and the dissimilarities between Iran and Alaska. I made them play a guessing game. I told them I wouldn't talk about Iran. But as I went down 15 characteristics, they were sure I was lying through my teeth and that I was talking about Iran. But I announced Alaska. I'll just give you some of those characteristics that you have in common. Oil, obviously. Both of you communities are now in oil development. With all the wealth, with their actual, at least perceived, that oil represents. Surprisingly enough, you have a common neighbor, the USSR. And when I mentioned this mystical community that had on its northwest border the USSR, they were sure again I was talking about Iran. And then I talked about rapid growth and the development of a primate city, Tehran for them, Anchorage, and now Fairbanks for you. Some 10 times as large as any of the next cities in the hierarchy of this community. Incidentally, Tehran is growing by 500 people and 300 cars per day, if you want to deal with that. Also, the vulnerability of these two communities, both of them climatically extremely vulnerable, they to heat and the dry, and you to the cold. Vulnerable also to the forces, the geopolitical forces that surround them. One begins to understand the Shah, the power position and the power that he exercises by being caught between warring factions, the war going back, in their case, to 3,000, 5,000 years of conquest and being conquered, with great monuments built and ruins left behind. You can understand the Shah when you see this, and yet you have the memory of what I remembered, the Iranian student working in my mailroom at the School of Education who asked me not to go, to boycott the Shah because of the torture of political prisoners in that community. But the vulnerability of that community, of Iran, is undeniable. Alaska is a strategic in-between, but it has not yet been warred across as Iran has. The dissimilarities, well, I can give you one. The mayor of Tehran, who to contend with those cars coming in at 300 per day, new, has got 60 traffic policemen at any one time on duty for a city of 4.5 million people. Now, when I met him, he apologized he couldn't come to my seminar. I knew why afterwards, because he's a very outspoken mayor, and the Queen told him to quit going to conferences where he kept talking too much. But the mayor, when I asked him how he got his job, he said, well, I was Minister of the Environment in the central government, and I became unpopular, and so they punished me by making me mayor of Tehran. And I rejoined, and I said, you're one of the very few central city mayors I know of a large capital city in any country who doesn't have the privilege of telling the central government to go to hell, because that's what mayors do. They are usually, the mayor of the largest city is a political left where the central government is on the political right. And you can always, in the game of being a mayor, dump the problems on the central government. The Shah, different too than our rulers, because the Shah does not have, he thinks at least, the luxury of letting his people go anywhere, let alone to hell. I talked to a number of people before I spoke and after I spoke, because it got to be a test of whether I could speak directly to the condition of the Iranians under a regime beleaguered on the one hand and repressive on the other. And that's why I decided to speak in terms of the allegory and the facts of Alaska, because I presented Alaska as another oil-developing community which has grown on the premise of freedom, individual freedom, local freedom, indigenous, native freedoms, letting people have their head and stopping the restrictions, and indicated the promise of extending that kind of freedom because of the energy and the creativity which it released. But a very sensitive young reporter came up to me afterwards, who obviously was not going to report this, got the message and said quietly to me, Paul, he said, I know what you were saying. You were saying, in effect, to this regime, let the people express themselves. Let them have their head. But you know what would happen in this country? If the Shah said, do what you want to, they'd throw rocks through windows. Now, the contrast between an Iran and Alaska is extremely sharp. But it indicates, I think, that there are other communities who are watching what you are doing. The vitality of American federalism comes, I think, through the strength that the whole and its component parts have. To start with diversity, and by a magic of self-restraint and creativity, to turn that diversity into a real community. And the further strength of that federal system, its vitality, is that the same system that converts its diversities into community then makes certain that community is not turned into conformity. Why now then revisit your constitutional convention? Why revisit the American Constitution 200 years after, 20 years after? I'd argue from one point of view that it's unnecessary. Both documents, yours and the American, in defining the political process have succeeded. Both are documents that need, I think, only the flesh and blood of living with, the changes that come through the incremental creativity. When we've run into a tough decision, we find a way of adapting those instruments. Both instruments have the capacity to change. And you have changed yours, as well as the Supreme Court changing yours, and you have participated in the changing of the national constitution. I'd start then by saying, in a way, it's superfluous that you would reconsider documents that have defined your political process and constructed it in such a way that they are working, working well, and working creatively. But I do see a reason for your coming back together. I see a reason for people watching you from different places, not least from the states down below. Because the challenge now is to do the same constitution building for our economic order that we have done for the political order. Let me repeat. I think our documents do well in organizing, controlling, regulating, giving creativity to the political process. It is now the economic order that is under review. We do not have a written constitution for the American economy, nor for the world economy. But that economy needs the kind of systematic look that you gave your politics 20 years ago and the framers did 200 years ago. Because the economic order, loosely defined, working in its own way, is not producing a community out of diversity. Is not producing a community out of diversity. In the United States, look at the split that is now taking place, dividing our society regionally and socially. And they come together because what we now know as the Sun Belt, the prospering area of the South and the Southwest, is beginning to hive off, split away from the old urban order of the Northeast and the central part of the United States, which was built on the industrial system. There is a vast migration now away from the old industrial order, the factories, the slums, the central cities that it created, and a move, an exodus to the Sun Belt, and now we'd have to include Alaska by calling it, I guess, the Ice Belt. Carter, Ford are well aware that a difference of 100 years has now taken place. Where 100 years ago, the North was running free and fast and prospering, going into the industrial order, the South, coming out of an obsolescent agricultural order, was a decaying area about which Faulkner finally wrote an epitaph. Blacks moved north to those industrial orders when we mechanized agriculture in the South. And now we have in the North an old plantation system of industrialization with a slave class beginning to emerge in our central cities. old people, poor people, black people, Puerto Ricans, who are caught there while employment and prosperity moves out to other areas, and are more and more caught because the nation does not provide an economic system which guarantees that no matter where you are born, no matter where you may move, you have at least basic sustenance and health programs. But look at the world, because the same economic order has been now transposed into the world circumstance. I'm not talking now capitalism against socialism. I'm saying simply that the basis of industrialization, of development in these countries, is carrying the same kind of order to them. With these results, that by the year 2000, 4/5 of the world's population will be living in the less developed nations. The less developed nations have been growing economically at the rate of 6% per year in the 60s and 4.2% per year in the 1970s, with no gain in per capita income for all those populations now numbering over 3 billion. Now that produces what we are now talking about as the widening gap. No matter how fast you bring this economic order, how fast it develops in all these nations, it has done more to produce an elite group within those nations, a controlling minority, literally in 33 countries looked at by the World Bank, the top 5%, their incomes totaled 30 times the amount, total amount, of the bottom 40% of those populations. So it is aggregating a lot of power in the hands of a few. And more than that, conditions are deteriorating. Their environment is deteriorating. Their city conditions are deteriorating. If you were to see Iran, you would know what I mean. Now, Alaska stands in between. A developing community that has the luck of the oil producers, of having something that the rest of the society needs and will pay for, prospects, depending upon when you get that rewelding done, of having a flow of income estimated prospectively of $1 billion to, I've even seen, $4 to $5 billion by the year 1990 as possible revenue flows into this society. The conventional economics are not going to produce a good future for you or for the rest of the world. I'm talking now not as a radical socialist, populist, academic. I'm a member of two boards of directors of corporations, major corporations, and I'm now talking the way we talk around the tables of those directors. If you want to take a look at what the problems are, go down the list. There is, overall, the test of credibility of the economic institutions by which we live. First, the credibility of government as an agent which can run free, though not necessarily hostile, to the economic corporations which preside over business, the world of the profit. We saw in Watergate a deterioration of public confidence for good reason, but if you take a look at the consumer polls, the Harris polls and others, and look at the credibility of the American corporation now and of the state in the sense of the public, you will see to what low levels that confidence and therefore the credibility has sunk. Corporations are now under fire for their social credibility. We went through in the late 60s the business of putting consumer representatives on corporations, and so Reverend Leon Sullivan is now a member of GM, but he stands there practically alone. In Europe, which is moving much faster than we, corporations, I think being pushed probably too aggressively by public legislation, are being converted from the instruments we have known to socially accountable institutions, with workers made members of corporate boards by law, in some cases, by just moving out in advance. corporations moving out in advance. But it is businessmen now who are recognizing and who are getting together to say, we have to face the fact that our credibility is in question. Also coming into question are the criteria of the marketplace and the kind of decisions which are being made. How do you decide whether an investment is profitable? Clearly, by an economic rate of return, and we have legitimized going to the highest rate of return. In my corporation, we do not make a capital investment unless we have put our staff and our entrepreneurs through a very rigorous hurdle process of talking about return on investment, on equity, all the other measures which we have. But the people who are making these investments are making them on both shorter-term considerations than a public really can for long endure, and on more narrow criteria than those of us who are in politics know to be necessary. Also coming into question are the ground rules by which we do our business. I've been keeping an eye on you. As you develop investment funds, the temptation to you is to do what the banks did with the ghettos, which is to redline where you are and send your money where you can get a higher return. It's going to be interesting to see how you invest these funds that come to you, both through the Native Claims Act and also through oil revenues and others into the permanent fund that you're now considering, whether there too you will go to where the capital return is by the numbers the highest, and saying in effect the local opportunities for investment are few and they do not compete. The accounting of costs, because it's now clear that our business accounting system cannot account for the public costs that are involved in investments. And I will bring it directly to home. My corporation is in downtown Detroit, but you've been reading about downtown Detroit, what a hell that central city has become. We have to go suburban by the calculus in which we're operating. That's where the paying market is. And we cannot put into our costs the costs of welfare, health in the downtown. And so I'm going to be a member of a corporation that will see the disappearance of its facility from where I think it still socially is needed. But we need a broader accounting of costs on decisions of such moment as that. Eyes are on Alaska. Are you a mature member, not simply of the American Union, but of the world community? Are you a vital part of a vital system? Yes, in terms of the narrower context of you are a vital partner in the federal enterprise, but are you a vital part of what's coming to us these next 25 years as 4 billion grows to 8 billion people? As we, like the French aristocrats, get pushed into a corner, the old order, marching to the guillotine, as the 77 group of nations begin takes over the UN, the oil group begins to bargain us into a corner, and our system is squeezed. Where are you, and where are we at that point? Are you a vital, mature force? Are you going to give a lead to where we have to go in the next 25 years, or are you going to repeat the development process we have known in other communities that made a Newark, New Jersey a vital place as long as the market was there and then was let slowly go to hell while those who could leave left and those who couldn't stayed? I find a lot of encouragement in the years I've been Alaska watching. You have begun to perfect what we call now in the international parlance development from below. You got to be careful these phrases because I know what that means in Alaska. But what I really, you know what I'm talking about. First, statehood itself. You took your future in your own hands. You did not wait for the continuance of paternalism out of Washington or out of the economic order. And you became a state so that you could effectively bargain your own birthright and deal with your own future. I've been most impressed, and I talked about this in Iran and before the House Banking and Currency Committee the other day, with the capacity of the natives in Alaska to show ability to bargain as equals. I wish you could have heard Charlie Edwards in my office not so long ago talking to Ernesto Galarza from the Chicano community of Los Angeles. Charlie saying, hey, why don't you just, you know, do what we did on the North Slope. Act like you own the place and then bargain. And Ernesto Galarza said, Charlie, give us the North Slope and the oil, we'll act like that too. But I got a deal with people who've been kicked off the land by mechanized agriculture in Mexico, who arrive beat in East Los Angeles, who don't know anything of pride. And he said they try to invent it, and that gets to be phony. Said, I went back to see my origins in Mexico because I was sure they told me wrong. They said my grandfather was an alcoholic, and he gambled away his property down there. I know what happened. The Mexicans took it away from him. So I went down there, and I did historical research, and what did I find? He was an alcoholic, and he gambled it away. What do I have to be proud of? That's Ernesto's work and his problem with the Chicano community, to give a sense of pride that is now a part of your own heritage here. To watch, and I sat there as I watched the oil consortium in the overheated schoolhouse in Barrow one night deal with the Eskimo community there and offer them jobs on the pipeline, and there was this cold but polite return. When do we start dealing as owner equals? You know, employment, yes, but we own the place. We own the oil, and how do we negotiate? I've been watching, too, as you begin developing instrumentalities that are part of the new economic order, which is development corporations. I know if I were to look behind the scene on Native corporations or others, the problems I would see, how much easier it is to talk about them somewhere else and to show performance here, but I've been watching performance and it's been growing. Community development corporations are a promise for the future, but it's tough going. And participation by the community in economic institutions and economic decision making is tough going. But when I talked to the House Banking and Currency Committee, I said, go north and take a look at what is happening up there for its promise, if not for immediately its performance. So there is an immediate opportunity now in front of you. You're symbolically dealing through the permanent fund, its prospects, with the process of investment. You're going to be taking a windfall, if that's what we would call it down below, and you would call it earned income up here, and you are going to invest this in the future not only of this community, but if you place your investments elsewhere or if you decide not to, you are also part of the investment process as much as Chase Manhattan Bank and the OPEC nations. And I'd ask, therefore, as you go ahead with your constitutional deliberations, the constitution of the economy, I'd ask these questions. What's the purpose of these investments you will make? I hope the top purpose will become the strengthening of community. Not simply this community, but of a sense of community abroad as well, because some of your investments could well go into other developing nations which do not have your reserves, and where your development investment could mean a great deal in those areas. Second, I'd ask, what participation? Who is going to be sitting on the boards up here of your fund, your corporation, your state, to make these allocations of resources? What criteria are they going to use? I would hope, first, that you blot out the distinction that we've been making in the argument between socialist and capitalist, between business investments and social investments. There is just a continuum of investment that goes from the 100% on equity down to the loss. And it's graded right down the line. And I'm not going to argue that every one of them on the very high return side is a bad social investment, nor would I argue that a loss is the worst business investment. but I notice that we use the words business and social to beat each other's brains out, when really we ought to be talking about the validity of an investment in terms of strengthening these communities. What kind of staff will you use? It'll be a temptation to go down to pick up some of the great investment analysts out of Wall Street, and I don't want to put them down. But remember that the experts from Wall Street are now behind the game that is talked about among boards of directors of American corporations as to how we can more adequately attune ourselves to social needs and put money behind them. The elements of institution building you're going to have to develop up here. Education in a very broad sense. We are a hungry population these days for learning. Senator Mondale has come out for lifelong learning. Britain has been doing a very interesting job on distance learning, as they call the Open University on television. But we've got to forget now that it's just elementary, secondary, higher. It is a total population that needs constantly learning opportunities, and you face the problem of doing that over distance. But to develop understanding of these problems is your greatest weapon. As I've talked with Charlie Edwardson, it was Charlie's capacity to understand the world oil system that made him a good bargainer and a helper of his people at that time. Also, you need access to decision-making and openness and fair process in decision-making. This is no longer a closed-door proposition. The society will not tolerate it. We need to open it up. And by the way, the process of opening is the greatest guarantee, I think, of intelligent decisions. Because it's surprising when you bring somebody in on the board how quickly they begin understanding and therefore make judgments which are different from some of the ones that they make out of ignorance. We need to develop in our society.